Maddie.
Charlie.
As a professor, you can dictate your own work schedule, right? You're the master of your own fate. You have full control of your life.
To an extent. They like me to show up for class.
That's sort of
non-negotiable, but yeah, pretty flexible.
And when you say non-negotiable, you mean you must, or it's sort of like a wink and a nudge?
I mean, I couldn't be mad at them for firing me if I did not show up.
it's the one thing that you're supposed to do, you didn't do.
Yeah. They're not going to teach themselves, you know.
Well, especially not these days. Have you seen the youth?
I have.
Ne'er-do-wells, all of them. No, we love you, youth. You're great.
We love the youth.
Youth. Shout out for your youth. So then what does your ideal work situation look like? And I mean, physically, if you're doing other stuff whenever,
mm-hmm.
Where do you like to be when you work?
Oh, well.
Mood board me.
I thought a lot about this, and I really like to be comfortable and in rooms full of soft things and needs to be quiet.
Yeah.
Needs to have a window.
Uh-huh.
But of course at work, I can't wear my, you know, gross sweatpants at work.
Of course.
So I still try to be comfortable, but when we were working from home during the pandemic, that was peak sweatpants time. And it was great, except when the pandemic, when we got called back to work, none of my pants fit.
Mm-hmm.
So
this is the dilemma of the sweatpants.
That was the dilemma, but I was really comfy and I got so much done because I was just in the zone in my little weird corner office at home. What about you?
Yeah. I mean, I also think that the pandemic was like this wake-up call because it felt like, it, you know, at that moment, my workspace could be anything as long as anything meant the sofa in my apartment.
Sure.
But I was really thinking about how comfort was great.
Mm-hmm.
And also, yeah, like a certain amount of privacy and silence.
Yes.
And a little bit of luxury.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. Right? Uh-huh.
Breaks so whenever.
I have two perfect ideals in my brain right now.
Do tell.
One is, so you know the movie Laura.
Yes.
And you know Waldo Leidecker.
Of course.
Our hero, Waldo Leidecker. There's a scene where he's like typing away on his typewriter and he's sitting in the bathtub.
Yes.
Iconic scene.
Yeah.
I'm sure we all remember it. And that has felt like the perfect work situation.
Oh, yes.
Just like I'm reporting to you now from my bathtub.
Do you have one of those cross the bathtub table things?
Oh, yes.
Things?
Oh, yeah.
Are you confident enough to use your computer on it, though?
Not yet, but I think the key is to not care.
Okay, because I care too much that I will drop something in the tub.
Yeah, you have more important things in your computer than I do on mine, I think.
Well, probably not, but I'm constantly afraid that it'll be like a $2,000 mistake.
Fair point. Okay, so then as a backup, less water involved is Roald Dahl's little writing shack, but not as it was in real life, as it was in the Wes Anderson little, like, you know, mini film series.
The little limited series. Yeah. Ooh.
Where he's got his, like, chair, his throne.
Yes.
And then he's got his little heater, and he's got his little blanket, and he's all tucked in.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
So that seems ideal.
That does seem ideal.
A little shack in the woods.
Let's do that.
Yeah. Much better.
Yeah.
All right. It's agreed.
It is agreed. Hello, folks. This here is the Juiciest Bits podcast. I'm Mandy.
I'm Charlie.
And we're here to talk about movies and
a nice, normal room that no one else can see.
And everything else in between.
And this is it. The final installation of our office movie set.
That's right. I don't know why I sounded so surprised. I knew that.
I'm shocked.
I just do whatever Charlie tells me.
It's not true.
No, I cannot be tamed.
We
all know this.
She's very mean. We talked about Corner Office.
We did.
Directed by a man named Joachim. And if you haven't heard it before, that's not surprising. I only know about it because I have an alert on my phone that is set to John Hamm facial hair. So when this movie came out, it made not a splash at all, but it did resonate with me.
Yes, of course. So that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. I'm aware that not everyone else is keyed into these issues like I am, but...
I mean, the hair game in this movie is very remarkable.
Yes. So it is impressive, mm-hmm. and I have a lot to say about it.
I'm sure you do.
More later on. Mm-hmm. So it's a relatively new release. It came out in...
22.
So really doesn't have the cultural oomph that Office Space and 9to5 have.
Right.
And would we even call it a dark comedy? Like, is it a comedy?
Yeah, I would say it's a dark comedy, surrealist comedy.
Yeah. By which we mean not really funny.
It's not funny, haha.
It's like, absurd.
It's absurd. Yeah. And it's like, ooh, okay.
Yeah.
That's that kind of comedy.
That's a weird thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
it's technically classified as comedy/mystery, and I was like, well,
I don't think it's really
I don't think it's either of those. Yeah. So I absurdist makes sense.
Yeah.
I would also say conspiracy.
Oh, totally conspiracy. Yeah.
Love a conspiracy.
Yes.
Okay, but before we get into it, give me one movie thing that another unrelated movie thing mm-hmm. that you've been thinking about since our last episode.
Yes. So last week I went to go see Civil War.
Do tell.
And I really liked it. There's a lot to like about it. It's very, it seems very prescient in a lot of scary ways. Mm. But I thought Kirsten Dunst was wonderful. In that
Nick Offerman will be our president soon? Or?
Nick Offerman will be our president of the president. World. Yeah. He will give himself a third term. And no, but it's very...
Is that what they're calling it these days? Yeah.
So it's about this photojournalist and this reporter. That's Katie. Kirsten Dunst is a photojournalist. She's kind of renowned. And there's a younger photojournalist who kind of adopts her as her work mommy. Mm. And I really liked it until the end, and I don't want to give anything away, but it just seemed like the end reverts back to tropes about non-men in movies where, there's a lot of sacrifice happening between, in this case, women that men are just kind of exempt from. Mm. And also this weird idea that there can only be one lady professional in a movie, or like only one non-man can be good at something. Mm-hmm. Like you can't have a group of people who happen to be just, you know, any gender being good at something.
Yeah.
So I found that very frustrating and very disappointing because I thought the rest of the movie was great. Mm. But yeah, the end just seems to rely on these old tropes that are very tired and
shoot,
need to die. Yeah.
Well, noted feminist Alex Garland didn't come through for you. We should have an episode about where we talk about Alex Garland, because I was dunking on him the other day with friend of the pod, Veronica, and she really liked men, and I really didn't like men.
Oh.
And I was basically saying that I think he's given a lot of, Alex Garland has given mm-hmm. a lot of praise for, you know, elevating female heroes or female characters and, like, you know, illustrating complex female issues, when really I feel like he's a very atmospheric director. Mm-hmm. And I think oftentimes, his strength in creating this atmosphere of mystery goes a long way to make a very simple thing seem complex.
Yes.
So yep. I think we saw that with Men. I think we saw that with Annihilation. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent we saw that with Ex Machina, although I think Ex Machina is the best of the bunch.
Yeah, I agree.
To me, I like think that Ex Machina is the best. Least easy to like sort of distill.
Yeah.
But
and yeah. Yet strangely, maybe the most accessible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting, hey?
Yeah. Aww.
Well, I'm excited to see Civil War.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what you think. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm thinking about seeing it again just to kind of, now that I know what's coming, kind of pay more attention.
Okay.
But yeah, first watch.
See the threads that are leading
pretty good,
to it.
But yeah. A little disappointing. Yeah.
Bummer. Well, I'm going to pivot to a very different thing.
Okay.
So on the weekend, wanting something stupid to watch while I was kitchen puttering.
Sure.
I put on the Maze Runner movies.
Oh.
Which, they're terrible. They're okay. Not interesting, except for like how baldly anti-women and anti-science they are.
Oh, so great.
Like, I really don't recommend. They're basically like, all women are terrible monsters.
Oh.
And also, science is bad.
Cool.
And young men are victimized by both.
Oh, won't someone please think of the men? The young men. The young, energetic men.
Yeah. So, anyways, that was an issue. But in the second movie, Alan Tudyk shows up for, like, two scenes as, like, a dystopian party louche.
Of course, we love Alan Tudyk.
And, yeah, no, this is my thing. So for, like, those exact two scenes, I was conned into thinking that the movie was good.
Oh.
Because he is so watchable, he's so funny, he's so great in everything.
He's the best. He is the best.
He is truly the best. Oh. So I've been just thinking about how he's, like, in everything, often, like, multiple characters and stuff, like...
Do you remember Death at a Funeral?
What?
Do you remember Death at a Funeral?
Oh my god, that's right, he's in that too!
He's in that, he's so good.
He's just, yeah, no, I can't, like, think about him without grinning.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he always brings this deep mix of, like, odd, like, pathos and also, like, deep, joyful weirdness.
Yes! Yes.
And it's that combination of, like, seeming vulnerable and also just, like, kooky at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And like, exuberant in that?
Yeah, he's not one of those off-putting characters that's too weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's so endearing in everything he's in.
Yeah.
Like, it's he's just amazing.
Yeah. And then I think Variety recently had him as one of their, like, so they've got a series that's like, name this quote from one of your movies or whatever, mm-hmm. which is, like, a boring premise to me, but... the entire clip was, like, so funny because he's so engaging.
Yeah.
And just had these great anecdotes. So, yeah, I guess what I'm saying is everyone, like, go watch all of Alan Tudyk's movies because he's great. And he's in way more things than you remember him being.
It's true. It's true. He's very unobtrusive.
Yeah. More Alan Tudyk.
Agreed.
I have a running list of people that, I would feel genuinely bummed if they turned out to be monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Tudyk, I think, is on the list now.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
For sure.
I would be very sad.
I would be sad. He's up there with David Tennant.
Yes.
Who I would be really bummed if it turned out he was a monster.
Yeah.
And Keanu Reeves.
Oh, yes.
Would also be very devastating.
But I've heard such good things about both of them.
Well, this is the thing. So. Like, it seems impossible. All signs point to no.
Yes.
And Channing Tatum.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Anyways, I'll stop listing people now. Can we describe this movie in four keywords or less?
Yes. So, this is going to seem alliterative until the end, but it's brutalism.
Mm-hmm.
Bangs.
Yeah.
Booties. And ennui.
Oh, failed in the last...
Or did I succeed because I got to use ennui?
Okay.
One of my favorite words.
This is a good perspective. Those are great words.
Thank you.
Mine are boring.
Hardly.
No, listen to this. Gray.
I was just going to ask if one of them was gray. I know you so well.
There's so much gray. Everything is gray in this movie.
Is gray. Yeah.
Clocks, because the clocks are weird.
The clocks are weird.
Surveillance.
Yes.
And mustache.
Of course. I was going to put mustache, and I assumed you would put mustache.
Yeah. I mean, the bangs are the mustache of the forehead.
That's true.
So
I've heard many people say that.
And he curls his bangs so they look
right?
like the mustache.
It's
also
so
it's like
bananas.
Two things happening.
Yeah,
there. Yeah.
He curls his bangs like a granny.
He curls his bangs like I curled my bangs when I was 12, which is too old to still be curling your bangs.
Mm. But, I still curled my bangs when I was 12 too.
All right. Yeah.
It was a different time.
It's true.
It was a different time. We had trauma, okay?
All right, may I do a summary?
Please.
Okay. This will be a weird summary because I'm using old notes. So wish me luck.
Good luck.
All right. All right. In the beginning, we see a car drive into a snowy parking lot where all the cars look identical and are covered in an identical layer of snow, which, side note, kind of made me realize for the first time how snow often serves as, like a similar purpose to dust, making it seem like objects haven't moved or disturbed in a long time. There's, like, a suspended quality to objects in snow.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
You can have that one for free.
Thank you.
In voiceover, our protagonist, Orson, John Hamm, wearing both bangs and mustache, tells us that it's his first day on the new job, and he feels like a child again, telling us that he's full of hope, like on the first day of school. Which becomes absurd, like, immediately, because he's walking through this imposing, nonsensical, like, brutalist structure into a Tower of Babel-type building. It literally cannot, like, the top of it can't be seen. Mm-hmm. And there literally might as well be a sign over the front entrance that's like, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Orson's narration continues to contradict what's literally happening around him. So he muses, "I know I've come to the right place," while walking, like, right past a clearly marked elevator. And then when he gets to his office floor and looks at the most bleak corporate space I've ever seen.
Oh, it's a bummer.
It is so terrible. He thinks, "Finally, I'll be able to blossom into my full potential." Like, what the fuck?
He likes work way too much.
Yeah, yeah. So, like, you might be tempted to think that there's some kind of ironic twist that Orson is giving to this commentary, but, like, no. Literally everything he's saying is matter of fact, like, to the point of, like, being pompous.
Yeah.
Like, he is so settled and smug in himself.
Yes, he is very arrogant.
While saying, like, the most insane things. Mm-hmm. So Orson is set up as sort of, like, you know, a boring dude, bit of a numpty who likes work and is used to being appreciated for his complete lack of imagination in the face of mountains of meaningless paperwork, you know, real nose to the grindstone type. So he doesn't appreciate when his new colleague, Rakesh, shows him around the office. He makes his own weirdly strict work schedule. He develops categorizations and hierarchies for all his office mates. But he keeps his head down and does his job, so everything's fine. One day, on his way to the bathroom, he sees a random door and opens it to look into a darkened room. Seems like an insignificant moment, until a few days later, when he's looking for copy paper. He goes into that room again, turns on the light this time, and sees that instead of a storeroom, it's this beautifully appointed mid-century modern office. Like, the complete opposite to everything else. Like the color palette, the tones, the soft lighting, like, full 180. Another time, Orson is reprimanded for not wearing the mandatory shoe covers by Andrew, the office manager. And so to decompress from this stressful situation, he goes back to that fancy empty office to explore it a bit more. And while he's in the office, sort of taking in the space, moving around, he becomes much more confident, more relaxed, and self-assured. So, like, you literally see sort of a physical transformation in him while he's occupying this space. When Rakesh's work habits irritate Orson, Orson decides to take Rakesh into that fancy office and tell him to cut it out, but, like, reasonably, man to man. Or, well, more like, actually, like, boss employee, because he sits down on the other side of the desk and gets Rakesh to sit across from him. And
very much condescends.
And is like, let me tell you. Yeah.
I don't want to have to tell you again.
Yeah, yeah. He does this weird thing where he, like, takes off his glasses just to, like, fiddle around with them. In, like, a very performative way. Mm-hmm. When they get back to their desks, Rakesh is a bit weirded out, but Orson chalks that up to the fact that no one's told him he's a slob before. It's only a bit later that Rakesh is like, "Dude, what are you doing when you just stand in the hallway facing that wall?" And Orson's like, "Excuse me, I would never do that.
That would be weird."
Yeah. Rakesh is like, literally everyone has seen that, you weirdo. So the next time Orson crosses the hall where the door to the fancy office is, he stops another coworker and asks him about the office door. And this other coworker at first is like, oh, there's no door. That's just like a blank wall. But then the coworker goes on to say, don't drag me into this. Yeah. Which objectively is a very weird thing to say to anyone. Yes. Especially if they're seeing imaginary doors.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep. Okay.
We can all agree?
Yeah.
Thank you. So naturally, Orson smells an organized conspiracy. To set the record straight, he calls everyone into the fancy office to tell them to stop talking behind his back and to show them, once and for all, that the space is real. Only afterwards, everyone maintains that he just stood with his head against the outer hallway while they stood around him, staring. All of Orson's coworkers complain to Andrew about him, but all Andrew does is sit Orson down and tell him that he's barred from visiting the room anymore. Actually, no. What he says is, like, you've created the room in your mind. And also,
yeah,
you can't go there.
The room doesn't exist, but also you can't go there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very weird.
Which is very weird. Yeah. Yeah. So there's this constant duality happening where people are like addressing the fact that this room doesn't exist, possibly. But then there's also, they're also treating it like it might.
Right. Yeah.
In the same breath. Very strange.
Very strange.
You can't forbid something that doesn't exist. Come on.
Yeah.
Okay, so another side note. Andrew, did you recognize Andrew?
No.
Oh, he's played by hometown hero, Christopher Heyerdahl,
oh,
who's a Canadian actor.
Oh.
And our national counter-argument to anyone who thinks that Canadians are too friendly. Because he's, like, always the creepiest motherfucker in the room.
Yeah.
He is so scary.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
You haven't watched enough trashy Canadian sci-fi.
I have not.
Clearly. He's always like a vampire or a time-traveling villain or something.
I can see that.
Or yeah.
Yeah, he has that energy about him.
Totally. Yeah. After being sent to a psychiatrist who seems extremely ill-equipped to deal with him, Orson eventually agrees to stop going to the room. At first, he's able to avoid it, but eventually the withdrawal symptoms are too much. And he starts sneaking back in late at night to avoid the detection of his coworkers. While he's staying overnight, he's also stealing files from Rakesh's desk and takes them into the room to work on them. When done, he sneaks them onto Andrew's desk. Then when it's discovered that Orson has suddenly been doing this amazing work, so there's like this like small mystery where it's like, is this Rakesh's work? Who could it be? Is it Carol? Who is it? Who is it? No one will take ownership. There's a sudden shift in the office. So Orson still isn't liked because he's too weird and off-putting. But people start to compliment on him on his work and, you know, at least tolerate his presence in the break room. And they even invite him to the Christmas party, which he decides to ignore at first, but then shows up anyways. At the party, the nice building receptionist asks to see the secret room where he does all his genius policy shifting work. And he takes her there. She says she can't see it, but asks him to help her enter it. Once inside, they really seem to share a connection. They do a little dance.
Very lovely.
Very lovely. But the next morning at the office, she's cold and distant when Orson tries to pick it back up. What could have happened? Sneaky. At this point, Orson does a little recon on the other floors, trying to map up where the room is in relation to the rest of the building. Turns out no other floor has a room in that same place, although all other details are identical. And then roughly around this time, also, Andrew gives him a... This is where my notes stop, so I'll just be vamping at this point. I also can't remember how it ends. No. Andrew gives him a super file to work on.
Yeah.
And
Andrew's very impressed with his work.
Very impressed.
And seems very surprised that he can do the work.
Yeah.
Which what, is like
he went from like the lowest common denominator. Like he was literally assigned to checking printer paper.
Yeah.
To now getting like one of the fanciest files, one of the most complex files that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And in what he thinks is a power play, Orson is like, okay, I'll work on this file, but you have to let me work in the room. And surprise, I've been doing work in the room all along. And this is too much. Andrew fires him instead. And after throwing a little temper tantrum in the main office area, Orson lets himself be escorted out of the building. But then he does a switcheroo and runs back in and leads them on a merry chase. And then he locks himself in the room while people are banging on the door. And in the final shot, we see everyone gathered around his, like, motionless figure staring at a wall. And then him in the room walking away with the voices fading in the background.
Mm-hmm.
The end.
Very well done. Good
thank
vamping.
You. Yeah, thank you, thank you. I watched this movie. What do you want to talk about?
So,
first of all, what the fuck is going on in this movie?
Yeah, so this is...
I have a lot of problems with this movie, I will say, also.
Yeah. So the movie is trying to be this sort of, like, is the room real, is it not real?
Yeah.
Sort of surrealist thing.
Because it really is sheltered from us for, I would say, 3/4 of the movie.
Yeah.
Whether it is, in fact, not real. Like, because we don't ever see him standing in the hallway for the first part of it.
Right.
We just see these quick transitions where they're in the main office and then he's in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And even when he's addressing his coworker in the hallway, the camera is very tight on their faces, so you can't see the room in proximity or the door to the room in proximity to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, although we do see the doorknob when he puts the receptionist's hand on the doorknob.
Mm-hmm.
And the door jams. So it's meant to be ambiguous, but it seems pretty clear that he's having some trouble balancing reality and fantasy.
Some trouble.
But the thing that kind of confuses me about the whole thing is that his colleagues are also very odd. They behave very oddly.
Yeah.
And so it seems like, they are being weird,
mm-hmm.
but they're also surprised he can do the job. So why did they hire him? And why are they kind of letting him walk all over everybody?
Mm-hmm.
And these things are never really addressed.
Yeah.
It just turns out that he thinks they're weird and they think he's weird, but
yeah, in different ways,
in
sort of incompatible ways.
And I just think, like, maybe because somebody did office surrealism so much better in Severance, I just feel like this, there are a lot of loose ends,
mm-hmm.
and there are a lot of things that don't really push far enough.
Mm.
Like, why is he the way he is because mm-hmm. there are a lot of signals that he's neurodivergent,
mm-hmm.
And that he is just lonely and doesn't mm-hmm. understand social cues and mm-hmm. all of these things. But he's just kind of, we're just kind of left to dislike him.
Yeah. I don't know if we're left to dislike him, but we're left to draw our own conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it is quite mysterious, because it's not that he is more or less unlikable than anyone else. Like, right. I would say Andrew is more off-putting than he is.
Andrew is very off-putting.
Andrew is a creepy-ass motherfucker.
Yeah.
And he clearly is, like, engaged in sort of power plays of his own.
Mm-hmm.
And he has his own secret agenda. And, yeah, like, you're right that, like, all the other coworkers are equally weird, just in different ways, which I think also lends this air of mystery or conspiracy, because it seems like they know something that Orson doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah, so I which then also makes it seem like they're all in something together against him,
mm-hmm.
when that actually doesn't seem to be the case. It seems like they all are just strange.
Yeah, well,
and in their own ways.
I'm just reminded, too, that most of the movie is through Orson's narration. So yeah. He, as an unreliable narrator, mm-hmm. frames his colleagues in a certain way.
That's true.
Which is, I mean, not to say that they're all actually totally normal. Like, I think uh-huh. there are a lot of things this movie does that other Office movies do, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. That are, you know, kind of normal things. But, yeah, like, Rakesh is kind of... Rakesh is so nice to show him around, but he's clearly disillusioned with the job, right? He's like, this is the coffee maker.
Yeah.
This is
These paper. Are the blinds.
These are the blinds. Like, it's just very, like...
This is the drawer of paper clips.
Yeah. Yeah, like, this sort of office mundanity mixed with the gray. Mm-hmm. Mixed with the big sign that says, we try to think about, or when Andrew comes up to his desk and points out his snowy shoes, he says, we try to think about the floor, and then points to a sign on the wall that says, think about the floor. And there's this little, like, booty machine that you stick your feet in, and it covers your feet with booties. Which is just, yeah.
So like, silly.
So silly, it. But also, yeah, such a middle management power move to, mm-hmm. like, we try to think about the floor here.
Yeah.
Like, not... take your shoes off, but more of like a guilty thing. But the thing that maybe strikes me the most is Orson's arrogance.
Yeah.
Right? Like Andrew talks to him in many ways the way he talks to everyone else, and he cannot handle it.
Yeah.
He cannot handle, like, Orson. Orson, like, he says at the beginning, he wants to be someone who could sometimes show other people what to do.
Uh-huh.
He wants to be a leader. He wants to be a person to be reckoned with. But then he walks past Carol's desk and sees, this is one of my favorite parts of the movie, he sees a drawing that clearly her kid did.
Yeah.
And it's the sun kind of coming out of the sea, but there's an island behind it.
Uh-huh.
So it's, I mean, it's a child's drawing, but he says the drawing was wrong. Flagrant inaccuracy. And like it's kind of like a bugbear for him the whole time, to the point where at the end
when as he's storming out
he's like, that drawing is wrong.
And
like,
another thing.
Yeah, like he just can't let it go. Like he has to point out everything that is wrong with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
But to him, he's untouchable. And then being in the room makes him even more confident. Like he stands in front of a mirror and kind of straightens up, and that's mm-hmm. when he takes his glasses off, and he just kind of treats the room almost like a lover. Like he's running his fingers along the desk and romancing it. Like he is like amplified in that office,
uh-huh.
but he's still just a regular asshole outside the office. Like he's
without
any ability to, I don't know. He doesn't run his fingers along his work desk.
No, he does not. That I know of. He does not. Well, it's weird because he, like that quote you just started with, in it he says he does want to be a person of influence, someone that they come to see. He wants to be seen as a leader. But he also is stipulating that he doesn't want to be an actual leader.
Right.
He doesn't want to be a manager or a team leader. He just wants something like to be a person of influence.
Yes.
Which is a very strange distinction to make.
Yeah.
As someone who clearly does want the authority, he just doesn't want the formalized authority. I was trying to parse that out too.
He wants the authority, I think, without having to show his work. Maybe. Because I'm struck too by the number of times he goes into the kitchen and sees the flickering fluorescent light.
Yeah.
And he's just like, somebody needs to do something about that.
Yeah.
And then at one point he says, you know, how many office workers does it take to change a light bulb? And he's really irritated that none
of his... just staring up at it as well.
Like,
yeah.
Like, he's mad that none of his colleagues have bothered. And he says, you know, like, all you need to do is unscrew the old one and screw in the new one.
Mm-hmm.
But then he walks away.
Yeah.
So he's totally willing to point out all the foibles,
mm-hmm.
but he is not, it doesn't even occur to him to lift a finger to fix them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But okay. Here's my other thought. If he is actually smarter than everyone, Because he's doing all of this genius work that's, like, revolutionizing the place mm-hmm. when he's allowed to be in the room. And everyone's, like, astonished and, like, how did you do it? And so, like, clearly he can show his work, is what I'm trying to get at. Like, he could if he wanted to, but he doesn't seem to want to.
Well, and here's the thing, though. Like, is he smarter than everyone else, or is he just able to kind of find a place of comfort to do his work? Mm-hmm. And he works best in that office because for some reason, I mean, mm-hmm. there's really no way to tell how he actually does the work if the office doesn't exist and he's just standing against the wall.
Yeah.
Like, how, where does he do the work?
Yeah.
But it's a, you know, unfortunate omission. But
that's right. Mandy wanted more mundane details.
No, I just want, you know, it's like if he's just standing there against the wall, how does his work get done? He's
maybe... Right, IMDb goof.
It doesn't get... He's doing it.
Excuse me.
But when does it get written down? But yeah, like I think if I think about, you know, Carol and Rakesh and Stephanie, is it Stephanie?
Shannon,
the one that everybody ignores all the time. Like, they all hate it there.
Yeah.
It is not an environment conducive to creativity or even energy to work.
No.
So he has found a place where he can find that energy.
Yeah.
And everybody else is just like, this sucks. Mm-hmm. Like, even Andrew's office, like, they, so the floor plan is an open, just desks everywhere kind of floor plan, and some, the desks kind of face each other. So Orson and Rakesh face each other and other people face each other.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrew's office is kind of in the middle, but it's kind of this, it looks like a glass jail.
Yeah.
Like it's glass with these bars around the edge and you can see everything that goes on in there. And it just seems like even the boss has a terrible office. I would not want an office in the middle of the room.
Arguably worse, I would say.
Arguably worse, yeah.
Because it has, like, none of the privacy, and it's so on display, also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It would be better to just have, like, a normal-ass desk, because then you at least blend in a bit.
Yeah. So this place is just completely demoralizing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, if I had a mid-century modern office all to myself with a record player, I'd probably get more work done, too.
yeah. Where, okay, this, the problem of the room, I think we're finding all these snags.
Yeah.
But why does he want to return to the room? And is the room, because here's the other thing, he doesn't ever actually seem to leave. We only ever see him literally go out to his car and then come back.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's spending all of his nights there, and if, you know, like, it's sort of the question of, like, when does he go home? Does he ever go home?
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly don't see it. There certainly doesn't seem to be time for him to do it. So what is it that the room is sort of, like, giving him? Because it also seems to have this, like, hold over him. It's like an obsession. Where he, like, physically, like, his body sort of, like, wants to return there. He feels, like, physical symptoms when he can't, like, go there. And then he literally breaks into his former workplace afterwards to go there again.
Yeah.
So if, I guess my question is, if the room is entirely in his head, why does he have to be in the office to go there?
That's a great question.
All right. Tell me.
I mean, because he doesn't know it's in his head. Or, like, I was fully expecting the end of this movie to be, oh, he's been in a coma the whole time. This is all a dream.
It was all a dream.
Because just the disconnections and the weirdness, like, perfect for the it was all a dream trope. But, yeah, like, he's so convinced that everyone is just lying to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he honestly...
Or out to get him.
He doesn't realize... And the room gives him such an inflated sense of superiority.
Yeah.
That I think he thinks he deserves to be in there.
Yeah.
And that they're, you know, people are trying to take it away from him. And, like, because in there, nobody is making him feel less than.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And by...
Yeah, he literally becomes, like, bigger than himself because he stands up taller. his clothes fit him better.
Yeah.
He sort of becomes the best version of, or that he understands himself to be.
Yeah, and just the way he gets so offended by nothing. Like, he says when he's, you know, being asked to look for copy paper, and when he's looking for copy paper and he can't find it, he says that he feels humiliated even thinking about asking, even though, you know, they encourage him to ask because he's new. And he's like, I can't possibly, that would make me look stupid.
He has this, like, really insane line where he's like, I'm unwilling to expose myself to the shame and derision of asking people. It's like, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah. And, like, in the office or in the room, he doesn't have to ask anybody anything.
Yeah.
He gets to tell people what to do.
Knows where everything is already.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, all of the records are records he likes. All of the books are books he likes. Like, everything is exactly where he wants it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, and he thinks too that his suit makes him look more virile when he's in the office. Like, it's a very weird thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an odd one.
And he's, yeah, at one point he says, Rakesh carried out his duties with the same devil-may-care attitude as everyone else.
Taking breaks whenever he wants them.
Yeah, because, also, like many other Office movies, it's not clear what they do.
Oh, and it seems increasingly, I mean, like, any hint we get of their actual work is the most meaningless stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, at one point, Orson is tasked with compiling a list of phone numbers.
Yeah.
And so there's all these files, everyone has paper floating around, but, like, nothing is substantive.
Yeah, the stakes seem very, very low.
And they're always being threatened with, like, closure or termination.
Yeah, Mitchell is constantly terrified of being laid off.
But there also doesn't seem to be a reason why things would have changed. Like, there's sort of, like, again, coming to this sort of stasis element of this place, where the light never really seems to change. The clocks are all weird because they've got, like, the wrong number of notches.
Mm-hmm.
So you really can't ever tell what actual time it is. Like all of these things that sort of, like, keep this place seeming like time is not actually passing.
Which
again, so there's no urgency to the work, which means, like, why would the work change, or what would shut that off also?
Yeah, which again kind of leads me to think, like, this... is all a dream. Because even, yeah, with the clocks, there are 16 numbers instead of 12.
Mm-hmm.
All of the cars are literally the same in the parking lot. Like, everything is so consistently weird.
Like, glitch in the Matrix. When Orson goes out to the car, his car, at one point, and gets into it, like, earlier in the day. Like, he's leaving earlier in the day than he usually does. His car and the parking lot in general looks identical to the way that it looks when he drives in the first day.
Yeah.
Like, his car is the only one without snow on it. Everyone else's cars look undisturbed and untouched. So it also seems like no time has passed at all.
Yeah, and it is always winter. Like, who knows how long he's worked there, but it's the same weather all the time.
I was shocked when they had, like, a Christmas party. I was like, it's been winter for years.
Yeah, so again, it's like, is this whole movie in his head?
Yeah.
Is this all just... But again, the movie doesn't kind of let us know.
Well, it's weird to position it as... Because, like, if it's all in his head, why does he create this terrible other reality first?
Yeah.
In order to then breach that into, like, a further other reality, you know? Like, why the layering?
Yeah, but I guess, like, when you...
If you're trying to escape from something, why would you create sort of a hellish situation first in order to then create, like, a beautiful, like, safety room after that?
Maybe he doesn't know how to lucid dream.
Oh, well... Yeah. My boy, I've got stuff to teach you.
And I don't know, I mean, the movie does not at all
It doesn't tie up any of these things.
It doesn't tie up any of these things, but But it, yeah, there are all of these little consistent inconsistencies that yeah. seem like they're out of a person's head, where they don't necessarily make sense, but they make sense to that person.
Yeah. And it's also all presented as very matter of fact.
Yes.
So at no point, like, at no point is Orson ironic or winking. And also at no point is, like, the language of this movie mm-hmm. ironic or winking.
No.
Like, this is a very matter of fact way of telling a story.
Yeah. And as I said before, there are so many touch points to the other Office movies we've watched. He even mm-hmm. talks about the office identities, right? There's the one who's been there for a while, the one mm-hmm. who likes being right all the time, the person who laughs at everything. Like mm-hmm.
the one who's paranoid about being fired.
Yes. Like yeah. everybody has their role, and then he comes in and thinks that he's unique
mm-hmm.
In a way, but he's like all of these things except the laugher, right? He's the yeah. one who likes being right. He's the one who needs attention. He's
yeah.
he needs the attaboys all day long.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, everything seems centered around him. Uh-huh. I mean, because it's his narrative, but it would be so, like, there's actually very little dialogue in this movie.
Mm-hmm. No, he has, his narrative is constant.
Mm-hmm.
He just won't shut up. And everyone else is so peripheral.
Yeah.
I wanted to also ask what you thought of the fact that whenever he is thinking about, like, he often compares himself to a child.
Mm.
So when he's walking into the office the first day, he's like, it's like I feel like a child again, like the first day of school. And then a number of times when he goes into the room, or even when he's thinking about going to the room, he's like, oh, it's like a child at Christmas, or like, it's a child,
yeah.
at, like all of these things. And I also thought that was a really interesting puncturing of what otherwise looks like a very serious endeavor on his part. Like, he yeah. never seems to contain that kind of childish joy. And also all the things that he's doing seem very serious to him,
mm-hmm.
Even if they seem like sort of silly on the outside.
Yeah.
So it was always like a jarring moment for him to compare himself to a child.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah. Well, because you're right. Like, he takes himself extremely seriously. and you know, the first time he gets into the room, he says, like, this whole room breathes tradition
mm-hmm.
or something. So he's grounding himself as part of that tradition. And he says, this is what monks feel like as they walk through the corridors of monasteries.
Oh, yeah.
And so he's likening himself to a holy man or a monk. But then, later on, when he's told he can't be in the office, he kind of sulks and says, why does Andrew get a room and I don't? Which is like, well, he's the boss, so
also his room isn't really a room.
Yeah, but also like that, what a childish thing to
yeah.
say. Right? And the whole like kids drawing thing where he's critiquing whatever a 5-year-old's crayon drawing, like
I guess he does have a bit of petulance to him.
Yeah, but it's never so obvious as it is when he's yeah, like the sort of kid at Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, kind of almost giggly and modeling in the mirror, and like he can really cut loose in that room.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, it sort of seeps through a little bit.
Yeah.
I think. But yeah, that yeah. Why does Andrew get a room and I don't?
Well, and at another point he's like, Andrew comes up to him and is like, oh, what are you working on, bud? And he's like, I don't want to tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
And Andrew's like, I'm your boss.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, there's absolutely no reverence for the hierarchy at all. Like, it's...
And well, I mean, also being constantly aware of it
yes,
at the same
because...
time. And even, like, implicit hierarchies that aren't explicitly stated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the fact that, like, Carol's sort of like the leader that he wants to be.
Yeah.
You know, those sort of like minute gradations of hierarchy.
Yeah, well,
among peers.
And Andrew too, whenever he has to say something difficult, he kind of cocks his head up and talks about the EVP.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is coming down from the EVP. So he's kind of passing the buck, but we're also getting that sense he's like the chairman of the board in 9 to 5, right?
Yeah.
It's like this
larger than life god figure.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like...
Never seen, always felt.
Yes, exactly. But this, it never seems to register with Orson. Like, we never see the EVP. Orson doesn't really seem to think much of the EVP.
Mm-hmm.
Just like he doesn't think much of Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think he thinks he should be running that office, or that at least they should want him to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which brings me back to sort of my confusion about his fixation on hierarchy while also dismissing the actual hierarchical, like, strata that are in place. And not quite sure how to deal with that. Because, he wants a different version of the hierarchy than is presented to him.
It's like he wants to be a king, not a... like president or something.
Right.
Like, he wants complete...
like a dictator.
Yeah. Like, he wants people to do things the way he wants to do them, and he wants things just so and just his way.
Yeah.
And it, like, he doesn't want to work with people, clearly.
Yeah. I'm thinking about... and this might move into theme corner. Ooh. But, I mean, we're just talking about office stuff all the time. So theme corner doesn't make any sense right now. But it's all theme corner.
I've held back a lot of things for theme corner.
Do you? Oh. All right, let's do theme corner. just like what the space of the office itself. So I'm trying to think of ways in which corner office is different from Severance or some of the other office movies we've seen. And I'm wondering if one of those is trying to parse how literally, like, the architecture of the space changes people.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's necessarily something we, like, they're sort of gestured at in Office Space and in 9 to 5. But I think here it's, like, really made explicit, because there's, like, lots of buildup on the, like, entry into this building.
Yeah.
And lots of sort of, like sweeping examinations of what this terrible office looks like and how bleak it is and how the lights flicker all, you know, like,
and how it's called the authority
and then also the sharp contrast between how the office is and that idealized room, which in itself is also a bit weird since it's so old, like, old-fashioned and sort of, like, harkens to, like, a good old boys club,
and also not a corner office.
Also not a corner office, but it does have a window.
It has a window, but it's in the middle of a wall. Like, it's, or the, yeah, it's, I find that so interesting. Yeah, it's a step out of time. And I mean, a lot of people have kind of said, ooh, the anti-Don Draper, because mid-century modern makes people think of Mad Men and John Hamm's Don Draper, but it seems so out of time.
Yeah.
And out of place, but it also...
is, like, exclusionary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exclusionary. And the whole idea of a corner office is meant to be exclusionary.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also meant to be this sort of display, this attitude. It's more of a feeling.
Yeah.
But this office
You're taking up space. Yeah.
And so this office doesn't exist. So it's not taking up any space. Literally takes up no space. And the space that he's imagining it doesn't even make sense as a corner office.
Yeah.
And I mean, that combined with the fact that they're only on the fourth floor of this building that reaches up to, you know,
the heavens.
It kind of seems like small potatoes.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Like, Orson is not aspiring to be anything particularly great. He just wants people to know he's smart.
Yeah.
Which is, like, I'm sure a lot of us can identify with that. In some way.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't, our behavior isn't quite the same as Orson's, but...
not quite as erratic, you would say?
No. Yeah. Or at least erratic in different ways.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I was just thinking about, like, what are the ways that we can think of architecture as shaping work and as shaping people?
Yeah, well, that takes me back to your question about ideal workplaces too, because mm-hmm. if a place is so awful, mm-hmm. like if it's just so cold and so dark, it's very dark in there as well. Mm-hmm. How do you expect anybody to get anything done? Mm-hmm. Like, it just seems like such a slog. And also, Andrew isn't really a taskmaster. Like, it just seems like people sit around all the time and don't really do much. All he cares about is that they think about the floor. So it's not like in Office Space or 9 to 5 where it's like, we have to get things done. Yeah. It's kind of like, we have to just be here as a team.
Yeah.
And then we go home, but Orson is so not part of that team because he just cannot be in that environment. Mm-hmm. He hasn't acclimatized to that environment.
Yeah, there's something sort of like phantom-like about the office where mm-hmm. they're all just sort of drifting around, often barely moving at all. And at one point later on, and again, everything Orson says should be taken with a massive fucking grain of salt, but but when he sort of has his, like, you know, interstitial reversal where he's like, oh no, I won't go to the room, and he's sort of trying to incorporate himself mm-hmm. Into the team, he talks about how his previous tactic was too aggressive, too enthusiastic. Mm-hmm. And so actually, you know, his new mode is to be much chiller.
Yeah, which is like, that guy can't be chill.
Yeah, no. Also, you think that's chill right now, what you're doing, bud? All right.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, just so like another point to that. That
yeah.
They need to be like moving as little as possible.
Yeah. Well, even to the point where, I mean, the one thing he does to emulate his coworkers is he tries to be like Carol by ignoring Shannon when she asks him to go to the Christmas party. Yeah. Which is like, that's not like, Shannon is the nice one who just wants people to do things and have fun, and like poor Shannon is ignored all the time. But
I mean, to be fair, Shannon is very annoying.
Very annoying. But like, when he doesn't answer her, it hurts her feelings, and that made me sad.
You're a good person.
Thank you. But yeah, it's like, is it worth it? Like, is he trying to fit in, or is he just kind of trying to steal Carol's power?
Yeah.
I think it's that he's trying to steal Carol's power. Which is kind of the same thing when he joins them in the break room. He just kind of stands there as they talk, and he thinks he's one of the group, but really, he says something about how he's like there as a, I can't remember the word he used.
Like a physical presence.
Yeah. He's very much setting himself apart from the group anyway. Yeah. Like he's almost.
So he's like there like as an object rather than a participant.
Yeah. Well, in this, I mean, it also reminds me of something he says at the beginning where he's putting himself on this very strict schedule, like 55 minutes of work and then, mm-hmm. you know, I don't
five
know,
minutes 5 break.
Minute break and then. And then, so in the middle of his 55 minutes of work, he had to pee, apparently. But he powered through anyway, so his work schedule is more important than even his bodily functions. Like, he ignores his bladder, just like he ignores his colleagues. Like, work is paramount. And so, if he can't get work done in the bullpen office area because of all the files getting put on his desk and all the people looking at him, then it does make more sense that he would want to retreat into his own space. Mm-hmm. Even if none of it is real, which mm-hmm. I kind of maintain has to be the case.
But no, I don't want, we've talked about this before. That whole, like, it was all a dream,
oh,
or they were
it.
Sleeping
at
the
like
whole
it.
Time, or he was actually a ghost. Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, it feels lazy and not like a satisfying reveal at all. But I also feel like
we don't get a satisfying reveal anyway.
That's true. I just want to make, I want to have more faith in it than it has in itself.
Yeah.
I want it to do better.
Yes.
want to buck up, old champ.
Like, what a twist would it have been if the office was real and they were gaslighting him?
So this was kind of one of the things that I wanted to ask you, is how much better of a movie would this have been if the office was a real thing the whole time?
Yeah.
And everyone else was just like, nah, you're a crazy person.
Yeah, it would have been so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, we find out later that it's some huge government conspiracy, like Cabin in the Woods. Like, I would have been like, yes, nice. But instead, it's just like, and
or even over. That they're like piping drugs through the vents, or like the lights are flickering on a frequency that like hypnotizes everyone to see something different, or you know, like
he was hired as an experiment.
Yeah,
and
somehow his mustache is like impervious to these things, so he sees it anyways.
And it's to see like how quickly somebody folds under the heavy boot of capitalism, or like. There's so many ways this
movie... The answer is immediately.
Yeah, immediately. Yeah. There's so many ways this movie could have made sense.
Yeah.
But instead, it just doesn't.
Yeah. Which is too bad.
It is too bad. Like, it has real potential. And I love a good surrealist sort of thriller comedy.
Oh, and I love Jon Hamm.
And I love Jon Hamm.
And I love Jon Hamm's mustache.
Yes. And his
bangs.
And his head mustache.
And his head mustache.
And his face bangs. Yeah.
I think they call it a four stash.
I thought that was something else.
No. I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know either.
Okay. Let's think about... did you have anything else you wanted to say before we fully move on to Theme Corner?
No, I think I'm good.
Okay. Thinking about this in dialogue with Office Space and 9 to 5, what are some common threads that we can pull out, or some differences, or some disjunctions? What do you think?
Well, I think the work environment is really key to all three movies. The drab dreariness, the sort of deprioritization of human connection and need.
Right, the flattening effect.
Yeah.
It strikes me as interesting that in Office Space we have these, like, fully, like, walled-off cubicles where they can't see their coworkers, but they can hear them.
Mm-hmm.
And in 9 to 5, we have the teeny little, like barriers between the tables.
Mm-hmm.
So they can see and hear, but they're sort of, like, a nod to... you know, separation or privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And with this movie, there isn't even that.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the desks have like that teeny partition still, yeah. But
like very teeny, like a couple inches,
super teeny, yeah. Like hilariously small.
Yeah.
But Orson and Rakesh's desks don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
And, the sort of like big boss presence office is like, arguably the worst office of the bunch.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, you know, Dabney Coleman's office, which is, like, very fancy off the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we don't ever see where the boss's office is in 9 to 5, Office Space.
No.
He's just sort of everywhere. He like, pervades the space. Yeah, he hovers. Yeah.
So, like, the whole thing is his office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a... more interesting concept, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't hide.
I mean, in this one, I think it's interesting that the manager is clearly as powerless as everyone else.
Yep.
And the silly, like, glass cube that he's placed in is sort of, like, this pretense of elevation when really it's just sort of, like, as silly and ineffectual as anything else.
Yeah, and worse, as you were saying, because it's like, instead of privacy, it's like, everybody look at the boss now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I think equal issues with owner or worker ownership of tasks and work satisfaction.
Yep. Definitely.
Everyone sort of like equally disenfranchised.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, coming back to my favorite, Melville, this movie is so much more of an accurate adaptation of Bartleby.
Yeah.
Like, this is the Bartleby adaptation.
Definitely. He would prefer not to do anything.
He literally ends up, like, the whole central premise of him sort of, like, basically, like, winding down and becoming sort of a fixed point at the office while also, like, impeding work.
Yeah, and he refuses to leave.
Yeah, and he refuses to leave. So I think that's an interesting connection.
Yeah.
Get out of here, Office Space.
Yeah.
Corner Office is the new Bartleby.
Yeah, Office Space, you get the silver medal. Yeah,
silver medal in the Melville contest.
In the Melville contest, which is always happening.
Oh, always. I'm always thinking about the Melville contest.
Yeah, Melville is top of mind always. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think, I mean, obviously there's something about Bartleby that is resonant in every depiction of a terrible workplace, which is interesting because it's not just about one terrible colleague. It's about an environment that fosters this, this sort of behavior.
Oh, yeah. No, the thing about, like, the Bartleby story originally is that it's not just, like, it's how, like, the system is sort of, like, creating these conditions where the, like, both sort of, like, the worker and the boss are sort of, like, engaged in this impossible power play. And both of them feel exploited, and definitely one of them is much more exploited than the other.
Right.
But there are also these sort of, like, gestures towards, like, social good and trying to, like, have a paternalistic attitude towards your workers and how that is, like, toxic in and of itself. I feel like I got off track there, but
no, it makes sense. And yeah, what you just,
but
said,
it shows how, like, sort of everyone is kind of, like, equally complicit in creating this terribly toxic thing.
Right. Which I think is really important in Corner Office. The thing that strikes me about Corner Office as different from the other two movies is that while annoying, management is not really the villain.
Yeah.
They're complicit, but we don't see who's actually pulling the strings.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, we see, you know, some sort of, like, half-assed compassion mixed with ableism potentially for being surprised that he can actually do work.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, there's no, Dabney Coleman, you know, calling somebody toots, or, you know, there's no Lundberg asking somebody to come in all weekend, right?
That's right.
He's very, Andrew seems very much like he doesn't know how to be a boss and isn't really interested in bossing anybody.
Yeah. I mean, he is most interested in sort of acting as, like, a conduit to the EVP.
Yeah. But he never lays down the law. It's always like, oh, the EVP says.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't want that power.
What is the mouth of God called? The Metatron? He's like the Metatron.
Yes, he's the Metatron.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true that he doesn't have any authority on its own, his own. And so that everything, like, every decision he makes has to come from higher up.
Right.
But I think functionally for the workers beneath him, it ends up being the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's also how, like, hierarchy works in general, is that, like, it doesn't actually matter how many people are above you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this sort of decision, you know, there's no pushing back against that.
Yeah. Well, and some people take on this leadership role where they seem to have more power than they actually, or they take more power than they actually have.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of are the seeming authority figures, even though they don't have seniority.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm struck too. The name of the company is The Authority. So the company itself is the boss, but it's so faceless and essentially nameless.
Yeah.
What kind of authority is it? What authority does it have?
And to do what? Yeah. Yeah. Like there, everything is a blank.
Everything is blank. Yeah.
Mm. What do you think this movie is wanting to convey about office work?
That's such a good question.
Do you think it even knows? That might not be the project of this movie.
I think what it's doing is it's kind of imagining a dystopian office. Like it's just sort of trying to convey the dreariest, most demoralizing place, just like other office movies do, right? Just the drudgery, the sameness, the feeling that you can't escape it. You're just there. But I don't think it's trying to say anything specifically about office work.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a kind of convenient setting for this person who's imagining.
For sort of like the escapism that he's then trying to do.
Yeah, because I mean, who among us who have worked in an office haven't wanted to escape? from time to time.
But here's the catch, though. When I've imagined escaping from an office, I haven't imagined another office that I want to escape into.
Right.
I've been like, I want to escape to literally anything else.
Yeah. But all Orson wants is to work.
A better office.
Yeah, he just wants an office that's better than other people's offices.
Yeah.
Better than Andrew's office. That is somehow highly curated to his taste. Even though that office does not, nothing like it exists in that building.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a brutalist building does not have a mid-century modern office.
Yeah.
In it. Just hidden.
Yeah, and maybe that's as far as this movie it can go. Like, trying to gesture towards something that says certain types of work don't generate anything more than the illusion that they'll be better at some point. Or they sort of like keep you cycling through the motions, only imagining sort of like a slightly better version of the existence you have already.
Yeah, because the commonality is the assumption that office work is not essential, is low stakes,
mm-hmm.
is not terribly important or active in any way,
yeah.
which isn't fair. There are a lot of people doing a lot of work in offices that needs to get done. But it seems like that's a trope of its own, right? Office work is drudgery, it's terrible. You could do anything else and nobody would even notice you were gone.
Yeah.
Like that kind of thing. But also you need to conform, you need to dress the part, you need to, you know, do the stupid mundane things that your bosses tell you you need to do, including go to the booty machine and get booties.
Yeah.
Like, you need to do all of these little idiosyncratic things that are part of just your office environment, but at the same time, it's all meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another difference that sort of like also sort of drains this movie of power, I think, is that there's no home life to compare it to.
Right.
So I, again, with office space and with 9 to 5, there are reasons for these people to keep coming back into work.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, have debts, they've got families to support. They, you know, all these other things, that are reasons to keep re-engaging.
Mm.
And for this one, I mean, we sort of keep coming back to Severance because it is sort of like the most tonally similar.
Yeah.
Even though I think much more successful in what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But Severance effectively is able to sort of like wall off the work while also still showing us the home life as well.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of
it. Yeah. So we only have the one side of it in this movie.
Yeah.
Which I think really also drains it of power, because then, yeah, if you're just sort of like cycling through day after day, what is it all for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't get a sense of anybody's humanity. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just... Or even that they need this job.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
oh, why... the only gesture we get towards it is Carol's, like, the drawing on Carol's desk.
Yeah.
No one else that we know of, like, has family or partners or lives of any kind.
No.
And while we assume that they also go home at the end of the night, like, again, we have no proof. Mm-hmm.
But
they're
all,
just not there.
They all drive the same car and they all, you know, like, it's, yeah, there's no, I mean, the only individuality really we see is Rakesh's brown jacket that Orson hates at the beginning. And Orson is just appalled that Rakesh would wear this this hideous jacket that's so unprofessional. But then the next time we see Rakesh, he's in a suit.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, what? Why? Why is that? What's the reason for that change?
Yeah.
No way to know.
No way to know. well, a baffling movie all told.
Very baffling.
Shall we move on to moments of joy?
I think we should.
Very good. What were your moments of joy?
I had, well, I mean, I love that they all have to wear booties and that there's a special machine that puts on their booties
so
for them.
It's so silly.
It's so silly.
And also that, so then they all just, like, walk around with their, like, high heels
in booties.
These booties.
Which seems to be a safety hazard.
Which aren't even booties. They're, like, head caps.
Yeah, they're, like, those shoe coverings you get at hospitals.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but yeah, they
but they're
work
not
on
boots.
Your head.
Yeah,
yeah, they're kind of all-purpose elasticated
bags.
Bags, yeah.
So yeah, like so that. Walking around wearing those seems like a terrible idea.
Yeah, and wouldn't heels, like, puncture through them? And
maybe,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
We've, as discussed previously, this movie isn't big on logic.
We've just poked holes all throughout it. One thing I laughed out loud, there were two things I laughed out loud at. Besides the drawing thing, the child's drawing. One is when Shannon makes punch and, you know, she's like, oh, there's guava in it. And Rakesh says, I don't taste the guava. And just stone-faced Orson says, I had to agree with Rakesh that it was hard to taste the guava. which just struck me as such a Wes Anderson voiceover thing. Like, it's just so, like, so absurd, but said just completely straight-faced. And then, of course, my favorite thing was when Orson had done this very good work and Andrew is very pleased and he says, fob doodling genius.
Oh my God.
And I had to play it back with the subtitles because I was like, it sounded like he said fop doodling, but surely not. But yes, he said fop doodling, which is my new favorite word.
Oh my God. That is also one of my moments of joy. Cause I was like, what? What just happened?
And Andrew is not the kind of person who would say something like fop doodling.
No.
I don't know who is. Who is the kind of person?
Once again, a real head scratcher of a moment. Yeah. Okay, so fop doodling genius was a laugh out loud moment for me because I was like, what's happening here? What is this movie doing?
It's all falling apart.
It's all falling apart. And another moment was before the Christmas party, when they're planning the Christmas party, and Orson is sort of, like, off to the side trying to ignore it all, and people are talking about, like, oh, is Shannon gonna make the punch this year? It was terrible last year. She gonna do it again? And you just hear it, Orson's narration over it being like, I kept myself apart from the whole debacle.
Yes.
I love that.
Excellent.
And then also the jacket.
Oh, yeah.
He just gets so angry at the jacket. I seriously dislike that jacket. and it angers him so much, and it's very funny to me.
Yes.
It's a good-looking jacket.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. Also the fact that Orson clearly, like, curls his bangs.
Yes.
As discussed. Like, that is fully, like a curler situation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a single, like, loop.
Yeah.
It's not brushed out at all.
That's not a Gibson curl, is it? What is the, it's like a...
Oh, no, it's like...
It's a roll.
it's a roll downward.
Yeah.
So like a full on single, like it's like he took a 1-inch barrel curling iron, just did a little like whoopsie, and then like put it away and didn't comb it out. And so it's just this little log on his forehead.
It's very adorable.
It's very off-putting. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes him look a little bit like Shirley Temple. If Shirley Temple was an old man with a mustache.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you.
Maybe she was. No way to know.
No way to know. Stranger things have happened.
True.
Movie connections?
Well, the absurdity, as in Office Space, I think I found a connection there. And a 9 to 5, right? There's a lot of fantasy absurdity there. The Wes Anderson style voiceover, which I kind of... It got old.
And the over-the-top sort of, like it's so complex.
Yeah.
His way of talking is so Baroque and ornate.
Yes. So it kind of reminded me of that, except less whimsical.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Severance, which isn't a movie, but it's very cinematic. Mm-hmm. And it really has the same sort of...
God damn, Severance is so good.
It's so good.
It's so nuts.
And so, like, I don't know, maybe I would have liked this more if... I'd never seen Severance, but Severance just really seems to understand how to do boring office meets mystery.
Yeah.
Or something like intrigue.
Yeah, totally.
But with humanity as well.
Yeah.
It just does it better.
Right. Yeah. And that's the other thing. Okay. Coming back, like if you're making a movie about how to articulate this. Like, it's, I guess, tricky to make a movie about how a certain kind of work erodes your humanity. Mm. But, like, that's never going to be effective if you start from a place where the humanity is already eroded.
Yes.
Like, so, like, we have to have a place where we start from.
Yeah.
In order to, like, feel a sense of loss at what is taken.
Yeah.
And for this movie, we're already there. Like it's gone. These people are shells of whatever. They're like husks. But so we don't have a sense of them as humans who are put through, like, an ordeal that they're sort of now just, like, resigned to or whatever.
Yeah, there's no one we can really hold on to or root for.
Yeah.
Like, everyone is just sort of... meh.
Going through the motions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was sort of pushing this in another direction.
Oh.
Pushing it away from office work now and thinking about it in terms of, like, what are films where there is clearly, like, a strong imaginative component that is made, like that is presented as fact. And not necessarily, like, as the result of mental illness or, you know, like, so I think A Beautiful Mind was something that popped up immediately, sure. But, more just like, okay, what are movies that show, like, exercises in imagination?
Yeah. Well, The Truman Show just came to mind too. Like this whole idea of facade and,
Yeah, that's a good... I hadn't thought of that one. I did think of a movie called I Kill Giants.
Okay.
That is based on a graphic novel. And it's about this young girl who basically is sort of like a whimsical doomsday prepper. She believes that giants are coming to destroy her home and her life.
Okay.
And so she has sort of, like, built up this sort of, like, magical expertise. And she has all of these, like, rituals and incantations that she sort of, like, has developed, to keep her and her home safe. And you see equally through her perspective, where these giants are incredibly real and like a menace, the menace that she thinks they are. And then simultaneously you see how these giants are actually just like her way of grappling with a mother who's dying. Mm. And so everyone else is like, this is a clearly like very, very like damaged child, because of very real trauma and loss and like ongoing loss, like her mother's dying in front of her. And so her way of trying to like preserve her mother and keep her alive is to create these giants that she can fight.
Interesting.
And so you see that sort of dual reality like play out. So she is like literally fighting these giants, yeah, while her mother is like dying in bed at home.
Wow.
And yeah, so I thought it, well, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I thought it was a very powerful movie, and felt like, you know, kind of a potential connection in the way that it just sort of shows imagination as fact.
Yeah.
In sort of a larger world.
Which also, I mean, this is probably nothing like the movie you just described, but it makes me think of The Telltale Heart, just in terms of like that feeling of conspiracy, that someone is out to get him and it's his sleeping roommate's eye. So he has to destroy his roommate because that hideous eye is staring at me all the time. And then just imagining that the heart is beating under the floorboards where he buries the body, and mm-hmm. the police come and they're having, you know, tea mm-hmm. on the floor under which the body is, and he's just paranoid all the time, mm-hmm. but very, very in his own head about mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. that's gone on. Mm-hmm. You know, like the roommate clearly wasn't trying to attack him. Yeah. The police were not there to arrest him at first.
Yeah.
Like everything is just normal, but in his world, it's not, and he has to be in control.
Yeah.
Of everything until he can't be anymore.
Uh huh.
So yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that also holds. Like, I mean, we're talking about ways in which, the world becomes larger and stranger because of tricks in perception, basically.
Yeah.
So this is like magical thinking. This is, you know, where I think a lot of magical realism comes from, where you're mm-hmm. just like, these possibilities, these pockets of potential exist in the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, you know, can be delightful. And in this movie, wasn't.
Nope. I agree.
Yeah. All right. What did we learn? Juiciest bits, juiciest butts.
Well, I learned to always let someone else mention the secret room first.
Well done.
Thank you.
So how do you go about that conversation? You're in the hallway with a coworker and you're like, hey, what'd you do on the weekend? Try any new recipes lately? What do you think about doors in general?
I wish there was a nicer office around here that I could just relax in.
For the listeners, Mandy is stretching out and preparing for a widow nap.
Yep. I mean, it did not escape me that the couch in the room is the same as my couch. So, it's like, is my living room real? I hope so.
And I think the answer is no.
I like that couch, though. It's nice.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely get someone else to mention the secret room first. Mm-hmm. Although, very tricky when it's a secret room.
Very tricky, but not impossible.
So I guess, yeah, the trick is to first get people to take you into their confidence.
Yes.
And then go to the secret meetings where the secret room is mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then you can all agree that it exists.
It might be like a Harry Potter Room of Requirements situation.
Oh! Yeah. I mean, we didn't talk about this. This could actually be the answer to everything. The room literally stops existing when he stops looking at it.
Yeah.
That's why no one else can see it.
Totally. That would have been an interesting way to take the movie.
Yeah.
That they just decided not to do.
Yeah, yeah.
One more way
Hard they turn could away. Have
made the movie better and decided not to. What did you learn?
I learned that, you know, carpet won't ever rebound from the slightest bit of moisture. It's just not what it's there to do. Carpet must be protected at all costs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, literally no measure is too much.
No. Booties for all.
Booties. Keep saying booty.
Well, speaking of booty.
Big booties, little booties.
All booties. All. Who had the juiciest one in this movie?
The juiciest booty.
I'm going to say John Hamm on two counts because he has.
He's got the hams.
He's got the hams and his literal booties were wet with snow. So.
Oh!
They're juicy.
Get out of here. Hate it. Don't like it at all.
No, you love it. I know you do. You're just mad you didn't think of it first.
I am pretty mad. That mustache. We haven't talked enough about the mustache. The mustache was pretty juicy also.
Yes. The face one or the forehead one?
Oh, I was saying the face one, but okay. The forehead one also. Yeah. The forestache.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about the face bangs.
Oh, yes, the face bangs.
That's okay. Right. I was confused, so I'm glad we could clear this up.
We need a dictionary for this. Oh, yeah. Some kind of lexicon for John Hamm's hair.
It's true. I mean, get on that.
Do you think that was his real mustache?
No.
Do you think that was his real hair?
No.
Oh, devastating. On both counts.
I mean, yeah.
Do you think he grew out that hair, made the wig, and the mustache wig, and then wore them?
Had it all cut off and woven, rewoven.
Yeah, and dyed that perfect salt and pepper color.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Is it possible?
It's possible.
He has a real, like, real hard work ethic, I think. A real do-it-yourself, can-do attitude.
Yeah.
I think he could.
Oh, I think he could. I just don't think
he could. The question is, would he? Yeah, all right.
He's kind enough as to give the hair and makeup people something to do.
All right, yeah.
Instead of just looking at him and being like, you may go.
I've got this.
Nothing to do here.
I'm just... brings in Ziploc bags of his own hair. I've been harvesting this for years.
What can you do with it?
Oh, no. Oh, well, all right. That's been Office Movies.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed.
I would say that it was as fun as Heist Movies, but that'd be lying.
Yeah.
Heist Movies just were better in every way.
They're definitely more exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe we should do something exciting again.
I mean, something criminal?
Possibly.
I think so. We've been law-abiding citizens long enough.
Truly.
All right. Well, we'll discuss that off air.
Stand by.
But for the juiciest bits today, I have been Charlie.
And I've been Maddie.
See ya.
Bye.